You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko menua toko ingoa, nau mai, haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora, and welcome to the Wire Wharapa Wednesday. I'm your host, Manny, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in the studio by producers Toby and Theo. Efi Akane coming up on the show for our weekly catch-up with the Green Party. News director Castor spoke with the Greens' newly announced tax policy. They also spoke to Professor of Taxation Lisa Marriott about the recently announced KiwiSaver policies and the practical implementation of these Green Party taxes. Then I spoke to visiting fellow at the Australia University's Crawford School of Public Policy, Dr. Jacob Priegaard, about the Australian robotic controversy and how we can watch out for the tragic mistakes they made as we automate decision making in our welfare system. Theo, what do you have for us today?
I spoke to Professor Gemma Geegan on the arrival of the H5N1 bird flu in Australia. I also spoke to Dr. Timothy Fadgen on a proposal for an emergency protection framework for refugees that he co-authored.
Toby, what do you have for us today?
Well, I'll be introducing a segment that Castor has done, speaking to tax expert Lisa Marriott about the various proposed taxes that the parties have made.
Awesome. He aha o whakaaro. We'd love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku patahi mai, text in on 5395. Ko wā e wareware e ahe ana koutou te whakorongo ki anei kororo anō. Hei piki heri ruki ruki maronga i te pai. Tuku tuku urirangi poho me haere ke 95 ire kati com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
Now it's time to hear from the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March.
This past weekend, the Green Party announced its tax policy for the upcoming election in November. The tax policy primarily looks at increasing revenue from some of the wealthiest members of society, the super rich, using tools such as a tax on assets worth over $10 million. The party is also proposing an income tax cut through the introduction of a new 0% tax bracket at $10,000. This would see everyone's first $10,000 earnings annually entirely untaxed, which the Greens say will rebalance the tax system to work better for the working class New Zealanders. Despite the Greens pushing for these policies, Labour Party leader Chris Hipkins immediately ruled out the vast majority, stating they would not support such taxes if elected into a coalition government. In the past, Labour-Greens partnerships have seen the Green Party abandoning a large portion of its left-leaning policies in favour of Labour's more centre-left stance. A key question going into this election is if this pattern could continue, or if the Greens would fight harder to back their policies if in government. For this week's catch-up with the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March, News Director Castor asked him about each of these issues.
We saw the Green Party announcing some of their tax policy for this election over the weekend. If you could just briefly go into what the philosophy behind this tax policy is and what the Greens are trying to do here.
Right now, the super rich are ripping us off. As a country, we are the wealthiest we've ever been in yet. 1 in 7 children are growing up in poverty. Homelessness rates are through the roof. And what this tells us is that the tax system is not working as intended, and that the billionaires are being able to continue getting richer at the expense of everybody else, which is why we propose a range of new taxes, predominantly targeting the super rich, as well as the rebalancing of the income tax system that would see a tax-free threshold so that we actually start taxing wealth more as opposed to work.
And there's been a lot of mention of this group, the super rich, in developing and talking about this policy. Could you go into a little bit more detail about what that group is? What really defines the super rich? Is this someone we might know?
Well, you know, this could be your Peter Thiels, your Mowbrays, and we're talking about people. And when it comes to our super rich tax, it's a 2.5% tax on net assets on the super rich who have a $10 million or more asset. And this excludes the family home. And we're also proposing lifting, for example, the corporate tax rate for large corporations. And this is simply reversing something that the previous national government changed. And this will only affect 0.7% of the biggest corporations. But we're also proposing, for example, a tax on big tech. We know that big tech is once again ripping us off and also causing harm to our communities through the lack of regulations on, for example, social media. And we think that this could be reinvested into people having access to better healthcare, more affordable lives, and public services that actually meet the needs of everyone.
And on the other end of things, we're seeing a proposed income tax cut. This isn't something that the Greens have been, I guess, known for campaigning for. What is this policy and how would it affect people?
Yeah, so like in Australia, we are proposing having an income tax changes that would see a new tax-free threshold for the first $10,000. And we would then create a new tax rate for those that earn over $160,000. This is simply a rebalancing that would see 96% of New Zealanders receive a tax cut. Most people will end up paying the same or less tax when it comes to their income tax. We think this is fair. Right now, everyday workers are taxed far more proportionately to the mega rich. And this is simply also keeping us in line with Australia. And we'll go a long way, particularly to supporting students, people in low-wage jobs, and the unemployed being able to have more money in their pockets. And this is exactly what the National Party should have been looking at when they were thinking about rebalancing the tax system. The tax changes they introduced, for example, benefited high-income earners the most and gave the least to those on the lowest incomes, and that's not a fair rebalancing of the tax system.
Rebalancing has been a lot of the talk around these proposed tax changes, and you talked about what National is offering. If we're looking at what different political parties are talking about going into this election, especially with cost of living as such an important issue, how confident are you and the Green Party at large that this is a policy that will really help address that high cost of living that we're seeing right now?
We're very confident that our tax policy will not just rebalance the tax system to give everyday workers a fair deal, but it will ensure that the super rich contribute their fair share so that we can actually, for example, have more affordable food, lower energy bills, to ensure that actually we can create more jobs. And we'll be announcing our vision for those things later on the line. But what I want to make it really clear is that no matter what HIP can say relating to ruling out our proposals, it is the voters who get to choose the kind of tax policy and the vision for the economy that you want. So if you want to tax the super rich and ensure that everybody else gets a fair deal, only a party vote for the Green guarantees a change of government, but a progressive government as well, where we take bold action to address the affordability crisis as well as the climate crisis.
I want to talk about Hipkins's comments a bit there. I know you've mentioned that it doesn't matter so much, but Hipkins has said, you know, Labor disagrees with the majority of this announcement, that they're not interested in introducing some of these taxes. And we've seen in the past when the Green Party has joined coalitions with Labor, there have had to be some big concessions. Are they going to, I mean, would we see any changes to that if the Greens and Labor were to enter a coalition deal after this year's election? Are the Greens planning on fighting for more?
So this could be the first time we actually enter into a potentially formal coalition. And the thing here is that it is not up to Hipkins to rule out a wealth tax. It is up to voters. The stronger our vote compared to Labour, the more chances that we'll have at having a stronger negotiating hand at pushing for a tax on the super rich, but also for making our public services more affordable, making them free, and to stop the privatization that the National Party has been pushing for. And on top of that, better environmental protections. So whenever you hear Hipkins rolling out things like the wealth tax, I want to remind voters that it is simply not up to him. Voters will decide the kind of makeup they want for this government. And this is why only a party vote for the Green is a vote for a change of government, but more importantly, for a government of genuine progressive change.
And lastly, about Labor's capital gains tax policy, we saw the capital gains tax see a bit of attention during the last election before Hipkins ruled it out, and this election we saw announced quite early into the cycle. I know a capital gains tax is something that the Greens have talked about before. Is this something that the Greens would be interested in working with Labor to develop if elected later this year?
We've put out our own proposals on tax reform, which we think will bring more revenue, will actually address wealth inequality to a far more deeper and structural level than what Labour is proposing, and will allow us to do more to ensure that people can have affordable lives. Like I said, it is time for political parties to get real, that the super rich are ripping us off, and we need genuine progressive solutions to address that, that will ensure that working people can have dignified lives and the services that they deserve. And this is why, unlike Labour, we are campaigning on a much bolder vision for the economy, one that serves the needs of everyone, not just the wealthy few.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March discussing the Greens' new tax policy and how it could be implemented if elected into government. Please let us know your thoughts on any of these interviews today. Text in on 5395 or call us on 309 3879.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March.
This is Lowdown by Dog Power. We'll be right back after the short break. That was I Love My Leather Jacket by The Chills, and before that was Low Down Dog Power. You're listening to The Wire on 95BFM. You can text in on 53954 or call us on 093879. Let us know if you have any thoughts on these interviews. We'd love to hear all of them.
Children eat worms and bugs and all sorts of things when they crawl in around.
The Wire.
Following the release of the budget and the reports that thousands more civil servants would be losing their jobs to right-size the government, a bill quickly passed under urgency to allow the automated decision-making throughout the social welfare system. The Social Security Modernization Amendment Bill was passed without the normal consultation processes as it was sped through Parliament. With the national-led government reforming our welfare system to enable automated decision-making, there are concerns that we may find ourselves in a similar scandal to the robo-debt issue in Australia. So, to understand this, I reached out to the visiting fellow at the Australian University Crawford School of Public Policy, Dr. Jacob Priegard, to talk about what happened in Australia when they enabled automated decision-making and how we could avoid it here. To begin with, what is the robo-debt controversy? How did it begin? What were its intentions initially?
Robodebt was the name given to a welfare compliance program run by Australia's Welfare Service Delivery Agency. It began in the 2015-16 budget, and its intention was to save $1.7 billion over 5 years by pulling that money back from welfare recipients through automation. So the way it worked was by comparing fortnightly social security records of current and past recipients with their annualized tax office returns. So when the system noted that there was a discrepancy between those numbers, a letter was automatically generated that contacted the recipient at their last known address and asked them to disprove that discrepancy. If they could not do so, a subsequent letter was sent with a debt notice. So there's some obvious problems in that it reversed the onus of proof from the government to the recipient. So rather than the government proving a debt as it used to in the previous human-run model, the recipient had to disprove the debt by going back to past employers to highlight their earnings or any information they could get to show that the numbers the government had were incorrect. This disproportionately affected people who had inconsistent patterns of work, which described more than 90% of people on welfare in Australia. So the scheme came under enormous pressure very quickly, in part because the use of automation to generate that savings had increased the amount of reviews under this scheme from 20,000 human reviews a year to 20,000 automated reviews per week. So that resulted in two Senate inquiries, two ombudsman investigations, and eventually a class action lawsuit in which the scheme was deemed illegal. And that resulted in the largest compensation payout by a Commonwealth government in Australian history of more than $1 billion. That was followed by a Royal Commission that gave astonishing insight into how the scheme was put together and that there was little to no consideration of how to safeguard vulnerable people. This was partly evidenced by reports of suicides in response to some of the debt letters that occurred back in 2017 and 2018. So the scheme ran in total for nearly 5 years. Even while all those investigations were occurring.
Now, at the end of it all, how would you say robo-debt is considered within the Australian mind?
It's led to a large lack of trust in government services. One of the distinctive things that occurred was that with vulnerable people receiving letters or these debt notices, a lot of people just assumed that they were correct, even though that we now know that as many as 30% of them were not actually true debts. The way that the algorithm and the automated calculation was working was coming up with incorrect debts. So people were so scared and terrified of the debts and that debt collectors would be coming after them that they were just paying the debts. To then find out afterwards that the entire scheme and the stress that they were put under was actually illegal, it's just generated a real collapse in trust of government services and in the social security system. In terms of the politics of the question, the Labor Party that's in government now ran the Royal Commission into the scheme, and they've generally been of the view that the scheme was illegal, it was problematic, and that we need to reduce the amount of compliance work that we do in the welfare system and be more careful about automation The coalition that was in government at the time has generally taken the point of view that the specific way the debts were calculated was the problem and that was illegal, but there was nothing ethically wrong with chasing vulnerable people for debts.
How did the story sort of break? When did it start sort of coming out and people started to understand that there was a problem here?
So the story kind of broke very quickly. So in early 2017, shortly after, like mere months after the thing had been released, it started to generate a lot of traffic in online communities that there was something strange going on here and that these debt notices were different. And it was particularly generating traffic because it was pushing everybody towards online systems. So people were trying to figure out, who do I contact to talk about this? Because I don't understand it. Because the scheme looked back initially 5 years and then 7 years, so it was looking at people who had past debts. So, you know, in 2017, you receive a letter and you'd last been on welfare in 2013, and you're receiving a letter that says that in 2013, you actually were incorrectly paid Social Security and you owe the government money. You might have to then go back to who you were employed by in 2013, whether or not that business still exists or anybody knows you who still works there, and ask them for records of your employment at that business in order to then take those records to Centrelink. So that very quickly started to generate a lot of noise. The government kind of played that down initially, started saying this is, you know, a new program, there's new processes in place, it's just teething issues, everything's legal, it's legislated, it's fine. The pressure built over a large period of time, and it was generally just contested by the political class and the public service. So there was a Senate inquiry followed by an ombudsman inquiry, which the departments worked with and gave information to, that resulted in some curtailing of the, you know, the worst excesses. So a phone number was added, additional support was put in place that people could contact somebody to talk about their situation. But the scheme still kept on running with the same automatic assumptions of discrepancies. That led to a second Senate inquiry, a second ombudsman investigation, and it was only shut down once the court deemed the scheme illegal. And it was that illegality that actually shut the whole thing down, and that illegality that spawned the Royal Commission. Because at that point in time, the question then becomes, like, how is an illegal policy created in the first place? So the inquiry was very much legalistic, much more than ethical. It was very focused on how did the illegal thing happen, rather than asking why we're creating schemes worth billions of dollars to recoup money from the most vulnerable people in the community.
I think it's worth noting that, as you said in the beginning, there's that flipping that happened from the onus being on the government to prove that this fraud was going on to it being upon all the people that were getting these reports. Diving into those calculations, could you illustrate to us how these things were going wrong?
Yeah, I think it's worth understanding what automation actually is. Like in the public discourse, we tend to talk about it in terms of being something that speeds up a process. You know, ministers like to talk about this, making things more efficient, making things quicker for recipients, making things quicker for consumers. From a public policy point of view, we would look at that a little differently. And we would say what automation is actually doing is it is about removing discretion from frontline workers in order to save those costs. So the efficiency is by having an automated system do the work instead of someone actually talking to a recipient in person. Now, the removal of discretion has benefits and has negatives, right? If you take away more discretion for a frontline worker who's talking to somebody, you end up with largely a more consistent service. But where you have people who have more complex cases, you end up with worse service and you are more likely to do harm to those people. So if you think about the case of RoboDebt, those 20,000 reviews that were happening per year in the previous system, while still large-scale compliance and, you know, trying to retrospectively take debts from people who may or may not have been supposed to have been receiving welfare before, the onus was on the government and on the frontline worker to work with the person accused of having the debt, to work with their financial institutions, to go back to their employers and figure out if that debt was real. So that discretion that was there was in that investigator and that person on the front line to ensure that there was accuracy in this system. There is a human oversight there. Once you move to RoboDebt, the automation component and the bit that was delivering that large saving was removing that discretion. It was removing that frontline worker from that part of the process, and a frontline worker would only become involved if the person contested the debt. So one of the key lessons I would take out of it is, where do you put human oversight in an automation process? It's one thing to talk about safeguarding, but if your safeguard is at the end of the process as it was in RoboDebt, the person has already received a discrepancy letter, which they may or may not have answered or been able to adequately respond to through digital channels, which I might add were the only channels available. And then they've received a debt letter, and then they've challenged, and then the human oversight has begun. So where you put the safeguard and the human component into that automated system is really critical. And it's especially critical in a situation where you're dealing with vulnerable people who, as I said before, will tend to assume that the system is correct about their information instead of assuming that the system is 70% correct and could be largely wrong.
It seems intuitive that if it's all online, the people who are most vulnerable are the least equipped to chase up a system like this. Whereas if you were going in to see a caseworker, they can help you resolve problems or help you understand what's happening. If things happened to go down a route that was similar to this in the New Zealand context, what would New Zealand need to prevent or recognise that something was going wrong and then fix that?
Look, there's a few things that probably need to be in place, but one is really clear vulnerability indicators inside the social security system. We didn't actually know in Australia how vulnerable the people being contacted were. So automated letters going to someone who's already dealing with significant mental health harms and challenges in other spaces led to suicides. The assumption going in was that the vulnerability indicators on social security records in Australia were sufficient and were in place, that vulnerable people weren't being contacted. They turned out to not be anywhere near as robust as what the government thought they were. I think real cognizance of where the human oversight is in the process. It's not enough to say there will be human oversight. Human oversight has to be at the right times and has to adequately cover for those vulnerabilities. So I think there's a real implementation challenge here about where you put the human in the process and which parts of that process they check in on and double check. The thing I would go back to more than anything else, though, that seems to sometimes be missed here is the complexity of the social security system in the first place. One of the reasons that all those debts were being generated in Australia and in the Netherlands is because the system was heavily means tested and very complicated. So the system was so hard to navigate that people were making mistakes left and right and didn't understand exactly what their rights were and exactly what they were engaging with. So those debts only existed because the system was so complicated in the first place. Automation is about removing discretion from frontline workers, and there is a genuine conversation, civic conversation there for people in New Zealand to think about how much discretion you want your frontline workers to have. How important is it that your frontline workers can give personalized service to vulnerable people versus having a system that is, say, faster, but automated, that doesn't give that personalized support? Because I think that's the trade-off that's being made, and they're legitimate questions to be asking for a government, and they're legitimate questions for a population to think about and discuss.
That was Dr. Jacob Puregard from the Australia University's Crawford School of Public Policy, pardon me, discussing the disastrous RoboDebt scandal in Australia, what we need to look for in New Zealand as the government automates decision-making, and the necessity to interrogate decisions that target the worst off and most vulnerable to claw back money.
Is it too late in the process, though, to change that?
Nothing's too late, bro. Everything's made up in politics.
The Wire.
The H5N1 strain of bird flu has now been detected in two dead birds that washed up on Australian shores. The first positive detection last week marked a major milestone. The avian influenza strain has now been found on all continents across the globe. For New Zealand and its already threatened population of endemic avian wildlife, the virus poses a potentially catastrophic threat. Given the virus's jump to mammals, including dairy cows in the United States, our primary industries may be placed in a potentially perilous position as well. However, the finding also brings with it an important reminder that New Zealand cannot rely on its geographical isolation and become complacent with the transmission of global viruses. However, that isolation has bought us some time. So to learn more about the steps New Zealand is taking and the trajectory of the virus so far, I spoke with the University of Otago's Professor Gemma Geoghegan. Kia ora, Professor Gemma Geoghegan. So first of all, starting off, what is the H5N1 virus? How does it differ from other viruses, or I guess more specifically, other bird flus?
Yeah, so H5N1 is a strain of avian influenza virus or bird flu that is really highly pathogenic. So that means it just causes really severe disease in wildlife, in domestic birds, in other mammals, and even humans as well when they get infected. And so these names come about because of the types of viruses they are. And so, you know, lots of different bird flus exist in wild birds. They're the natural reservoir for these types of viruses. And the vast majority of them don't cause severe disease in them. But this particular strain of H5N1, it seemed to have emerged in around 2020, 2021 in Asia, and has since then spread to Europe and the Americas. A couple of years ago, it got to the Antarctic mainland. And now, of course, we see it be introduced into Australia, which is the last remaining continent of this virus to infect.
That it's spreading so kind of globally, is that a result of wildlife or poultry?
Yeah. So we've known about bird flu since the 1990s because, you know, really just concentrated in around Asia, particularly around China. There was lots of instances where bird flus in the natural reservoir population, so these are mainly waterfowl like ducks and geese, would spill over into poultry and then become highly pathogenic. But mainly these outbreaks had been quite contained just to poultry industries. This time it's a bit different. So when this strain emerged in around 2021, it managed to jump back into wildlife. And by doing that, it genetically adapted to be able to infect a really broad range of different host species as well. So it wasn't confined to just waterfowl. It was able to infect lots of different wild birds. And now it's even adapted to be able to infect mammalian species too. So it's really down to the genetic adaptations of this virus has really expanded its host range. And by doing that, it's also expanded its geographical range. So that's why it's spread now to every single continent around the world.
And given that it has been able to spread to mammals now, I mean, what's the risk to humans here? I think everyone's probably a bit sensitive towards whether we'd see another pandemic anytime soon. What's the risk of that occurring?
Yeah, I mean, it has spread between mammals, particularly marine mammals, and it's now spreading endemically among dairy cattle in the United States. So it has been able to genetically adapt to some mammalian species. However, in humans, some humans have been infected, but for those humans to be infected, they have to have direct contact with an infected animal. And there is no evidence to suggest that this virus is able to transmit between humans. So humans can get infected, but only when they're handling an infected animal. So the risk to the general public is very low because it's not spreading between people.
Right. So far it's been detected in two dead birds that washed up in Australia. But given the number of birds and, you know, length of coastline in Australia and New Zealand, do we have any idea of how likely it is to be identified if it does come on shore?
Yeah, I mean, the detection of bird flu in Australia is really important. It's actually really significant, and it kind of confirms our suspicion that we're not as geographically isolated as we thought we might be. And so, you know, this geographic isolation has delayed its arrival, but the virus is much closer than it previously was. And the probably the most important thing as the general public need to know is that the first signs that bird flu will have reached our shores are probably signs of dead or sick birds or marine mammals. And so it's likely that a member of the public will stumble across it first. So it's important that they know what to do. Basically, the key message is don't handle it yourself, but call the MPI hotline so they will investigate and do some testing to see whether or not it is bird flu.
So given that it seems like it's more of a when rather than if kind of situation, do we know what kind of preparations New Zealand has made to deal with this?
Yeah, I mean, because of this delay, and we've seen it how this virus can spread around the world over the past 4 or 5 years, we've obviously learned a lot about what's happening overseas, and we can adapt those lessons to New Zealand. So there has been a lot of preparation, particularly for agriculture industries. You know, this will be a hugely significant event if it does arrive here. It will massively affect our poultry industries, as well as potentially different livestock industries too. And so there's a lot more preparation that can happen in these instances because, you know, you can control animal movement in domestic animals. What's more of a challenge is understanding the impact on our wildlife. So the Department of Conservation has done a restricted trial of H5N1 vaccine on some species of birds that are critically endangered but in captivity. It's really, really hard to vaccinate wildlife in the wild and manage that. It's also really hard to, you know, control movement, you know, particularly in birds and marine mammals. Can't necessarily lock them down like you can with humans or domestic animals. And so this is going to be the major challenge. You know, once it's here, it's likely to quickly spread around the country. And so it'll be more about doing rapid testing, using some of the lessons we did learn through other disease outbreaks, particularly in COVID-19, when we had genomic sequencing, for example, to understand, you know, how many times the virus has been introduced here, how it's spreading, and where we can kind of control that spread as well.
Given our wildlife has consists largely of birds, and that some of those populations are already quite small, I mean, what kind of measures would we take if it did make its way into our wildlife? Like, would we have to kind of see the same sort of cullings that we see in poultry, or are those vaccines kind of effective enough to curb it a bit?
Yeah, I mean, there are very effective H5N1 vaccines. As I mentioned, vaccinating wildlife populations has its challenges. So there are heavily managed populations that already undergo kind of GPS tracking and other management practices that could be more feasibly vaccinated than others. And so that might be sort of a challenge with the Department of Conservation and MPI to try and do that. You know, this is primarily an animal disease, primarily a bird disease. And so, you know, most of New Zealand bird populations are already threatened with other challenges. And so this could potentially be really catastrophic when it does arrive here. So, you know, taking these sort of preparation steps, doing vaccine trials is helpful, and to know how to manage this when it does arrive.
That was the University of Otago's Professor Jim McGeoghegan on the steps New Zealand is taking and the trajectory of the H5N1 avian influenza virus. If you do spot 3 or more sick or dead wild birds, marine mammals or other wildlife, call the Exotic Pest and Disease Hotline on 0800 80 99 66.
And I wish some of your dozy mates in the media had got a fix on their job and started being reporters and journalists, not editorialists and analysts, which they're not qualified to do. Prison company accepted, of course.
The Wire.
Globally, we're seeing a large increase in the number of people who have been forcibly displaced. By the end of 2025, we saw numbers that were 3 times those from 15 years ago. Looking forward, estimates are that by 2050, we may see up to 216 million people displaced globally. However, these increases have been accompanied by a decrease in protection. Funding has shrunk from meeting just over half of requirements in 2024 to just over a third in 2025. Given this need and the crises we're witnessing globally, researchers at the University of Auckland Centre for Asia Pacific Refugee Studies, alongside World Vision New Zealand, have argued that New Zealand's current ad hoc approach is not enough. Instead, they've proposed the adoption of an emergency protection framework for Aotearoa New Zealand that would provide a more efficient, fair and transparent pathway for refugees, consistent with New Zealand's international, humanitarian and ethical obligations. So, to hear more on the need for this framework and what it would look like, I spoke with one of the authors on this proposed framework, the University of Auckland's Dr. Timothy Fadgen. Kia ora, Dr. Timothy Fadgen. So starting off with a bit of a double-pronged question, why is there a need for an emergency protection framework in New Zealand? What are we seeing overseas, and how does our current model stack up?
Yeah, kia ora. Thanks for talking about this. It's a really important topic to us at the Center for Asia-Pacific Refugee Studies and also with our partners at World Vision and also for partners in the community here in New Zealand. So appreciate you talking to us about it. Well, it's a couple things. One, we have been doing some research into this and obviously work with the community on a regular basis on a whole host of things related to refugees and asylum seekers here in New Zealand. And the sort of reason for it being urgent at the moment is kind of due to a couple of reasons. The main driver is that we continue to live in a world with a high degree of instability overseas that can be both man-made with conflicts, as we're seeing sort of in various stages across the world, but also due to natural occurring events like climate disasters and naturally occurring events, eruptions and earthquakes and things that put people's lives at serious risk. That happens to be coinciding in this moment in time with a decline in global investment in responding to these disasters. So it sort of created a perfect storm of need for populations at risk.
So last week we had Fatima Sanusi from the Sudan Advocacy Network Aotearoa on, discussing her petition to establish a special Sudan visa modelled on the Ukrainian approach. They pointed to how the humanitarian crisis in Sudan has entered its fourth year, and there's been no real kind of special action from the New Zealand government. Meanwhile, with Ukraine, I think it was less than 3 weeks after Russia began their invasion, we created the special Ukrainian visa. So I guess my question is, how equitable or how fair is our current approach in situations like that?
So this is one of the core arguments, I suppose, that we put forward, or observations as a result of our research into this. This issue with New Zealand, it's very decisions about this, as your previous guests had noted, are done on an ad hoc basis, and that leads to inconsistency. And in our view, there's three main features to this critique. One is it's inequitable. It tends to offer different levels of support, legal status, family reunification rights. That's based on sort of just this sort of randomness of the circumstances. So some conflicts, this results, it will result in people being granted these rights, and in other cases, no. And that there's no real necessarily rhyme or reason to that. It's just sort of either the political agitation at the time, the public attention paid to a particular issue. But it's not a policy that's being driven by principle or an efficient approach to government, which our current government is big on advocating for. It's a process that basically leaves these determinations to the consequence of time. There's cost to a process that's not guided by a sort of set of principles or guidelines. And we think that that can be improved, certainly. But it's also not to mention there's just a lack of transparency, as your previous, your question sort of suggested. The public isn't really clear why some crises get this sort of, emergency visa set up in a special case and then other ones don't. And that's not really a good way to run government in our view.
And what kind of experience does that leave for refugees who come to New Zealand? Because it sounds like quite a precarious position to be in.
Certainly. And I think, obviously, the advocate that you had on before can speak more powerfully from the perspective of the refugees' experiences themselves, or the asylum seekers themselves. But in our experience, in research and engagement with these communities, it just leads to additional strain and uncertainty, particularly for those that are worried about family members who are left behind. So for those who are here when a crisis occurs, It's just leading, really for the reasons we talked about, to just exacerbating the problems that these naturally occurring events are already presenting to these populations, compounding that suffering, really.
So what would this model that you've proposed with your partners, what would this model look like, broadly speaking?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so basically what we're suggesting is, unlike, you know, to respond to the critiques that we've sort of put forward, the proposal would suggest, in our view, a predictable and transparent and equitable solution, okay? First, there'd be predefined activation criteria. So rather than relying on this ad hoc sort of approach to some conflicts that look a lot like others get protection and those other ones don't, there would be a set of criteria and competent individuals within the government and from the community, in our view, that would work together to identify the triggering events. And usually that's going to be caused by a loss of access to, let's say, healthcare or water in a war situation or in an environmental crisis. So some acute event that poses a significant and urgent humanitarian need. The other aspect of this is it's an anticipatory activation. So if there's early warning signs that something is likely to occur or become much worse in the near future, this policy would allow for the activation of this mechanism at an early stage. So instead of waiting until people are dying, this would allow for a more proactive response. And basically what we've suggesting, using the existing government models in certain ways, but just sort of solidifying them, is creating three standing visa streams: the emergency humanitarian visa, a bridging visa, and also the community sponsorship pathways program and an expansion of that. Now, I should say that this is sort of late breaking news because I just was notified of this just moments before we get on this call, but the government has just announced that the community sponsorship model is going to be made permanent, which is good news. However, in the time that has been running as part of the refugee response program in New Zealand, it's been in excess to the quota of refugee number of 1,500, which was a hard-fought battle to get the double the quota from several years ago, so some of your listeners might remember that. Then to top up over that 1,500, the community sponsorship model was put in place that allowed for community members and family members to sponsor refugees and to come into New Zealand that sort of were in excess of the quota system. But now that the government has made it permanent, 50 in the first year and then 200 under this program in future years, they now want that to be included within the quota. So we're essentially reducing the government's commitment to take in refugees as a whole. So even since this brief has been written, this is a sort of rapidly moving policy space, and we would still maintain that the government rethink that decision and that these numbers be expanded and that this mechanism be available to people.
Yeah, and if I recall correctly, the refugee quota of 1,500 people, the proportion of where those refugees come from is kind of worked out ahead of time. I think it's 3 or 4 years in advance. So would your model, it would sit outside the refugee quota?
That's right. Yes, this would be an additional mechanism that would allow the government the ability to target these sorts of crisis situations and to have an ordered humanitarian response. That's consistent with New Zealand's, ethical obligations, international obligations, and humanitarian obligations.
Right. Now, you've mentioned that it's a great opportunity to adopt a framework like this, given that it is an election year. However, in an election year, we do tend to see a lot of anti-immigration rhetoric as well, and we're seeing that a lot across the globe right now. How important would community buy-in be for this framework?
Political support for it? Yeah. I think, obviously, any sort of policy initiative like this, particularly in an election year, is going to require some political support. So there's no question about that. I do think, though, there's a little bit of a trap that people fall into in equating the general or generic immigration settings of government. So as government's making decisions about who to admit or who it wants to encourage to immigrate here for economic reasons with its humanitarian obligations. And in my view, for too long, these two categories have been sort of intertwined. And what we're saying here, and we have an opportunity in looking at this particular mechanism to say, there are instances where there are purely humanitarian reasons to intervene and to offer people a pathway to safety and to potentially to permanency here. And this mechanism would allow a very careful and thoughtful and deliberate approach to address that problem. I think that a political party looking for, you know, something to campaign on, or when if confronted with a difficult question from a constituent about a question like this, could thoughtfully make the distinction between those two types of arrivals to New Zealand. So, yes, it's important, but I also think it's a question of messaging and not falling into a convenient trap of sort of scapegoating migrants of all types, including those who are escaping persecution or in fear of their lives from these sort of natural occurring or conflict situations.
That was the University of Auckland's Dr. Timothy Fadgen on the Emergency Protection Framework for Refugees proposed by researchers at the University of Auckland Centre for Asia-Pacific Refugee Studies alongside World Vision New Zealand.
This is Conspiracy featuring More Mother and Gunja Sophie by Saul Williams. We'll be right back after the short break.
This world will kill you. It will prevent you from writing while torturing you for information. You learn what plants will not harm you, what to fight and what to report. Build relations within your society merely to survive or eagerly to prosper. Step back to step forward. Hold tight or let go. The decisions to make in instances without choice. Your own emotions may surprise you. Things may not always go as planned. Some truths are cliche. Discernment and nuanced judgment, solid reasoning, willful abandon. You will find yourself in love. You will lose yourself in passion. Work to find yourself again. You'll be forced to reckon with survival. You may find weapons, crutches, props, useful. You'll sing and dance. You'll discover instruments, varied means of communication. You may seek escape. You may depend greatly on outside forces. You may seek amends. You may find strength in prayer and meditation. You may build dependencies. You may choose a desire to belong. You may not have a sense of life's deceptions. You must develop means of questioning each song. Intuitive grace and space. Death is a conspiracy. Violence is reality. Love is in development. It can hold, contract, expand, adapt, take other shapes, lap in your face, clumsy with grace. Death is a conspiracy, religious hypocrisy. In the spirit of modesty, we are forever. Financed by darkest means, under the table, in the soil, underwater, sacred oil. Our fossils fuel the enterprise. Our fossils fuel our own demise. Our fossils hold no memories. Our fossils purely energy. Death is a conspiracy. Breath is life. Word, cry, kiss, song. Individual lives not long, not guaranteed, not weighted against intention. Random testaments of illumination. Anchored in faith. Tunneled by fear.
We're trying to find a way. We're trying to find a way. We're trying to find a way. I'm here when I disappear.
That was Conspiracy featuring More Mother and Ganja Sufi by Saul Williams. You listen to 95 BFM.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hotaka katoa mo tenei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa o koro mai ki mātou mo tenei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rapa Wednesday. Thank you to all of our guests, the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March, Jacob Beauregard from the Australia University's Crawford School of Public Policy, University of Otago's Professor Gemma Geegan, and the University of Auckland's Centre for Asia Pacific Refugee Studies, Dr. Timothy Fadgen. Nei rā huki, te mihi ki a koutou e whakaronga ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95 BFM.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.